Lynn Kendall didn't actually pass out, but she began to tremble, and when her knees buckled, Henry caught her and helped her to sit in her favorite chair facing the coffee table next to the couch. Dave didn't move. He just stared with wide eyes. Henry went into the kitchen and got his wife some lemonade and brought it back to her. "Here," he said. "Drink this."
"I want a damn martini."
"Honey, those days are over." Lynn was AA.
"I don't know what days are what," she said.
She was staring at Dave.
"He talks. The monkey talks."
"Ape."
"I'm sorry I upsetted you,"
Dave said to her.
"Thank you,
His name is Dave," Henry said. "He doesn't always get his tenses right." Dave said,
"Sometimes people get upsetted by me. They feel bad."
"Dave," she said, "this is not about you, honey. You seem to be very nice. This is about him."
She jerked her thumb toward Henry. "The asshole."
"What is asshole?"
"He's probably never heard swearing," Henry said. "You need to watch your language."
"How do you watch language?"
Dave said.
"It's noises. You can't watch noises."
"I'm very confused,"
Lynn said, sinking into her chair. "It's an expression," Henry said. "A figure of speech."
"Oh, I see,"
Dave said. There was a silence. His wife sighed. Henry patted her arm.
"Do you have any trees?"
Dave said.
"I like to climb trees."
At that moment, Jamie came into the house.
"Hey, Mom, I need a towel."
He broke off and stared at the chimp.
"Hello,"
Dave said. Jamie blinked, recovered fast.
"Hey, neat," he said. "I'm Jamie."
"My name is Dave. Do you have any trees to climb?"
"Sure, a big one. Come on."
Jamie headed for the door. Dave looked questioningly at Lynn and Henry.
"Go ahead," Henry said. "It's okay."
Dave leapt off the couch and scampered to the door, following Jamie.
"How do you know he won't run away?"
Lynn said.
"I don't think he will."
"Because he's your son."
The door banged shut. Outside, they heard their daughter screaming and shrieking.
"What is that?"
They heard Jamie say, "He's a chimp, and we're climbing trees."
"Where'd you get him, Jamie?"
"He's Dad's.
Does he bite?"
They couldn't make out Jamie's answer, but through the window they saw the tree branches swaying and moving, giggles and laughter from outside.
"What are you going to do with him?"
Lynn said.
"I don't know," Henry said.
"Well, he can't stay here."
"I know that."
"I won't have a dog in the house. I certainly won't have an ape."
"I know."
"And because there's no room for him."
"I know."
"This is really a mess," she said.
He said nothing, just nodded.
"How the hell did this happen, Henry?"
she said. "It's a long story," he said.
"I'm listening."
When the human genome was decoded, he explained, scientists discovered that the genome of a chimpanzee was nearly identical to that of a man. "All that separates our two species," he said, "is 500 genes. Of course, that number was deceptive, because human beings and sea urchins also shared a lot of genes. In fact, nearly every creature on the planet shared tens of thousands of the same genes. There was a great underlying unity of all life, genetically speaking. So that created a lot of interest in what had caused the differences in different species. 500 genes weren't a lot, yet a great chasm seemed to separate chimps from human beings.
Many species can crossbreed to produce hybrids.
Lions and tigers, leopards and jaguars, dolphins and whales,
buffalo and cattle, zebras and horses, camels and llamas. Grizzlies and polar bears sometimes mate in the wild, producing growlers. So there was a question of whether chimps and humans could hybridize to make a human Z. The answer seems to be no.
Somebody has tried?
Many times, starting back to the 1920s. But even if hybridization were impossible, Henry explained, one might still insert human genes directly into a chimp embryo to create a transgenic animal. 4 years back, when Henry was on sabbatical at the National Institutes of Health, he was studying autism, and he wanted to know which genes might account for the difference in communication abilities between people and apes.
Because chimps can communicate, he said. They have a range of cries and hand gestures. They can organize themselves into very effective hunting parties to kill small animals. So they have communication, but no language, like severe autistics. That's what interested me.
And what did you do?
His wife asked. In the laboratory, under a microscope, he inserted human genes into a chimpanzee embryo. His own genes.
Including the genes for speech?
She asked. Actually, all of them.
You inserted all your genes?
Look, I never expected the experiment to go to term, he said. I was looking to retrieve a fetus.
A fetus, not an animal.
If the transgenic fetus survived 8 or 9 weeks before it spontaneously aborted, there would be enough differentiation that he could dissect the fetus and advance his understanding of speech in apes.
You expected the fetus to die?
Yes. I was just hoping that it would carry long enough.
And then you were going to cut the fetus up?
Dissect it, yes.
Your own genes. Your own fetus. You did this in order to have something to dissect?
She was looking at him like he was a monster.
Lynn, it was an experiment. We do this kind of thing all the...
He broke off. No point going there. Look, he said, the genes were close at hand. I didn't have to get anybody's permission to use them.
It was an experiment. It wasn't about me.
It is now, she said. The question Henry was trying to answer was fundamental. Chimps and humans had split from a common ancestor 6 million years ago, and scientists had long ago noticed that chimpanzees most closely resemble human beings at their fetal stage. This suggested that human beings differed from chimps in part because of difference in intrauterine development. Human development could be thought of as having been arrested at the chimp fetal stage. Some scientists felt it was related to the eventual growth of the human brain, which doubled in the first year after birth. But Henry's interest was in speech, and for speech to occur, the vocal cords had to move down the throat from the mouth, creating a voice box. That happened in humans, but not in chimps. The entire developmental sequence was immensely complicated. Henry hoped to harvest a transgenic fetus and from that to gain some knowledge of what drove the change in human development that made speech possible. At least, that was his original experimental plan.
Why didn't you remove the fetus as you intended? She asked him.
Because that summer, several chimps contracted viral encephalitis, and the healthy chimps had to be moved away for quarantine. They were taken to different labs around the East Coast. I never heard anything about the embryo I implanted. I just assumed that the female had spontaneously aborted in a quarantine facility somewhere, and the fetal material was discarded. I couldn't inquire too closely.
Because what you did was illegal.
Well, that's a strong word. I assumed the experiment had failed, and it was over.
Guess not.
No, he said. I guess not. What happened was that the female gave birth to a full-term infant, and the two were returned to Bethesda. The infant chimp appeared to be normal in every respect. Its skin was somewhat pale,
especially around the mouth where there was no hair, but chimps varied widely in the amount of pigmentation they showed. No one thought anything of it. As the infant grew, it appeared less normal. The face, which was originally flat, did not bulge outward with age. The facial features remained rather infantile. Still, nobody thought to question the baby's appearance, until they discovered on a routine blood exam that the infant tested negative for the GC sialic acid enzyme. Since all apes carry this enzyme, the test was obviously wrong and repeated. It again came back negative. The infant chimp did not have the enzyme.
"Absence of that enzyme is a human trait," Henry said. "Sialic acid is a kind of sugar. No humans have the GC form of sialic acid. All apes have it."
"But this infant didn't."
"Right. So they did a DNA panel and quickly realized that the infant didn't have the usual 1.5% difference in genes from a human being. It had many fewer differences, and they started to put it all together."
"And tested the chimp's DNA against everybody who had worked in the lab?"
"Yes."
"And found he matched your DNA?"
"Yes. Bellarmino's office sent me a sample a few weeks ago, I guess to give me a heads up."
"What did you do?"
"Took it to a friend for analysis."
"Your friend in Long Beach?"
"Yes."
"And Bellarmino?"
"He just doesn't want to be responsible when word gets out."
He shook his head.
"I was driving home, and I was just west of Chicago, when I got a call from this guy, Rovac, at the animal lab, and he says, 'You're on your own with this one, pal.' That's their attitude. My problem, not theirs."
Lynn frowned. "Why isn't this a major discovery? Shouldn't this make you famous around the world? You've created the first transgenic ape."
"The problem," Henry said, "is that I can be censured for it, or even put in jail, because I didn't have permission from the committees that oversee primate research, because the NIH now forbids transgenic work on any animal other than rats, because all the anti-GM wackos and frankenfood nuts will be up in arms over this, because the NIH doesn't want any involvement in this and will deny any knowledge of it."
"So you can't tell anyone where Dave came from?"
"That's a problem, Henry, because you'll never keep him a secret."
"I know," he said miserably.
"Tracy's on the phone right now, telling all her friends about the cute little ape in her backyard."
"Yes."
"Her girlfriends will be over here in a few minutes. How are you going to explain Dave to them? Because after the girls will come the reporters."
Lynn glanced at her watch.
"In 1-2 hours, max. What'll you say?"
"I don't know. Maybe I'll say the work was done in another country, in China or in South Korea, and they sent him here."
"And what will Dave say when the reporters talk to him?"
"I'll ask him not to talk to them."
"Reporters won't leave this alone, Henry. They'll be camped outside the house with long lenses. They'll be circling in helicopters overhead. They'll be on the next plane to China or Korea to talk to the person who did this, and when they don't find that person, then what?"
She stared at him, then walked to the door. She looked into the backyard where Dave was playing with Jamie, the two of them yelling and swinging through the trees. She was silent for a moment. Then she said,
"You know, his skin really is quite pale."
"I know."
"His face is flat, almost human.
What would he look like with a haircut?"
And so was born Gandler-Crookheim syndrome,
A rare genetic mutation causing short stature, excessive body hair, and facial deformities that yielded a rather ape-like appearance. The syndrome was so rare it had only been documented 4 times in the last century. First, in an aristocratic Hungarian family in Budapest in 1923. 2 children were born with the syndrome, described in the medical literature by an Austrian physician, Dr. Emil Krukheim. The second appearance occurred in an Inuit child born in northern Alaska in 1944. A 3rd child, a girl, was born in Sao Paulo in 1957, but she died of infection a few weeks after birth. A 4th child in Bruges, Belgium, in 1988, was briefly seen by media, but subsequently vanished. His whereabouts were now unknown.
"I like this," Lynn said. She was typing on her portable.
"What's the name of that hairy syndrome? Excessive familial hairiness?"
"Hypertrichosis," Henry said.
"Right," she kept typing. "So Gandler Krukheim is related to hypertrichosis. Actually, congenital hypertrichosis langanosa. And there have only been 50 cases reported in the last 400 years.
"Are you writing that or reading that?"
"Both," she sat back.
"Okay," she said. "That's all I need for now. You better go tell Dave."
"Tell him what?"
"That he's human. He probably thinks he is anyway."
"Okay." As Henry walked to the door, he said, "You really think this will work?"
"I know it will," Lynn said. "California has laws against invading the privacy of special children. Many of these kids have serious deformities. They've got enough challenges growing up and going to school without the added burden of media exposure. Big fines if the media do it. They won't."
"Maybe," he said.
"It's the best we can do for now," she said. She was typing again. He paused at the door.
"If Dave is a human being," he said, "we can't very well send him to a circus."
"Oh, no," Lynn said.
"No, no. Dave lives with us. He's part of our family now. Thanks to you, we have no choice."
Henry went outside. Tracy and her friends were standing beneath the tree, pointing into the branches.
"Look at the monkey! Look at him!"
"No," Henry said to them. "He's not a monkey, and please, don't embarrass him. Dave suffers from a rare genetic syndrome." And he explained it to them as they listened wide-eyed.
Jamie had a trundle bed that he used when friends slept over. Lynn pulled it out, and Dave slept on it alongside Jamie. His last words were, "It's very soft." And almost immediately he was asleep, while Lynn ran her hand soothingly through his hair. Jamie said,
"This is so neat, Mom. It's like having a brother."
"It is, isn't it?" she said.
She turned out the light and closed the door. When she looked back in on them later, she found that Dave had twisted his sheets into a circle around him, making a kind of nest in the middle of the bed.
"No," Tracy said, standing in the kitchen, hands on hips.
"No, he cannot live in our house. How could you do this to me, Dad?"
"Do what?"
"You know what the other kids are going to say? He's a monkey that looks like a person, Dad, and he sounds like you with a stuffy nose."
She was near tears.
"He's related to you, isn't he? He has your genes."
"Now, Tracy,
I am so embarrassed,"
she started to sob.
"I had a chance to be a freshman cheerleader."
"Tracy," he said, "I'm sure you will."
"This was my year, Dad."
"It's still your year."
"Not if I have a monkey in my house."
She went to the refrigerator for a Coke, came back, still sobbing. That was when her mother walked in.
"He's not a monkey," Lynn said firmly. "He is an unfortunate young boy
who suffers from a serious disease. Oh, sure, Mom. Go look it up yourself. Google it.
I will.
Still sobbing, she walked over to the computer. Henry glanced at Lynn, then moved to look over his daughter's shoulder.
Hypertrichosis variant disorder reported 1923, Hungary. Gandler-Krukheim syndrome on Monday, 01 January 06 at 5:05 p.m. Doubtless, the hirsutism is secondary to QT/TD. The Hungarian cases showed no induration, according to 1923. Gandler-Krukheim syndrome, Inuit lawsuit, 1944. In the hectic days of World War II, the young Inuit boy suffering from Gandler-Krukheim in the northern Alaska town of Sanduck was treated by a local prostitute gives birth to ape child in Beijing. New China Post reports an infant with chimp-like hair and large hands and feet born to a Mongolian prostitute who claims to have mated with a Russian ape for money. Question whether this is Gandler-Krukheim syndrome, extremely rare condition. The Delhi Monkey Man, a new case of Gandler-Krukheim? Hindustan Times reports a man with the appearance and agility of a monkey, able to leap from rooftop to rooftop, frightening local residents. 3,000 police called out to Gandler-Krukheim syndrome from Belgium. Looking like a monkey, the young boy's picture appeared widely in the Brussels press, as well as publications in Paris and Bonn. After 1989, the child, whose name was Gilles, disappeared from public view. Translated, Syndrome Gandler-Krukheim de la Belgique, ressemblant à un singe, l'image de jeune garçon est apparue partout dans la presse de Bruxelles, comme les publications dispersées à Paris et à Bonn. Après 1989, l'enfant dont la nom était Gilles est disparu de la vue publique.
I had no idea, Tracy said, staring at the screen. There have only been 4 or 5 cases in all of history.
That poor kid.
He's very special, Henry said. I hope you will treat him better now.
He put his hand on Tracy's shoulder and glanced back at his wife.
All this in a couple of hours?
I've been busy, she said.
There were 50 reporters in the conference room of Shanghai's Hua Ting Hotel, sitting at row after row of green felt-covered tables. The TV cameras were all at the back of the room, and sitting on the floor up front were the cameramen with their bulky telephoto lenses. Strobes flashed as Professor Shen Zhizhong, head of the Institute of Biochemistry and Cell Biology in Shanghai, stepped up to the microphones. Wearing a black suit, Shen was a distinguished-looking man, and his English was excellent. Before becoming the head of IBCB, he had spent 10 years in Cambridge, Massachusetts, as a professor of cell biology at MIT.
I do not know whether I am telling you good news or bad news, he said, but I suspect it may be disappointing news. Nevertheless, I will set certain rumors finally to rest.
For some reason, he explained, rumors of unethical research in China began to circulate after the 12th East Asia Joint Symposium on Biomedical Research at Shaoxing City in Zhejiang Province.
I have no idea why, Shen said. The conference was quite ordinary and technical in nature.
However, at the next conference, in Seoul, reporters from Taiwan and Tokyo were asking pointed questions.
I was therefore advised by Baiyong J. Lee, the head of molecular biology at Seoul National University, to address this matter directly. He has some experience with the power of rumors.
There were knowing chuckles in the audience.
Shen was referring, of course, to the worldwide scandal that had erupted around the eminent Korean geneticist Hwang Woo-suk.
"Therefore, I shall come directly to the point," he said. "For many years, there have been rumors that Chinese scientists were attempting to create a hybrid of human and chimpanzee. According to the story, back in 1967, a surgeon named Ji Yong Zhang fertilized a female chimpanzee with human sperm. The chimp was in the third month of pregnancy when outraged citizens stormed his lab and ended the experiment. The chimpanzee later died, but researchers at the Chinese Academy of Science supposedly said they would continue the research."
Shin paused. "That is the first story. It is entirely untrue. No chimpanzee was ever impregnated by Dr. Yong Zhang or anyone else in China. Nor has a chimpanzee been impregnated anywhere in the world. If it had happened, you would know about it." Then, in 1980, a new story circulated that Italian researchers had seen human-chimp embryos in a Beijing laboratory. I heard this story when I was a professor at MIT. I asked to meet the Italian researchers in question. They could never be found. They were always the friend of a friend. Shen waited while strobes flashed again. The cameramen crawling around at his feet were annoying. After a moment, he continued.
"Next, a few years ago, was the story that a Mongolian prostitute gave birth to a baby with the features of a chimpanzee. This chimp man was said to look like a human being, but was very hairy, with large hands and feet. The chimp man drank whiskey and spoke in sentences. According to the story, this chimp is now at the Chinese Space Agency headquarters in Chaoyang District. He can sometimes be seen at the windows, reading a newspaper and smoking a cigar. Supposedly, he will be sent to the moon because it is too dangerous to send a human. This story, too, is false. All the stories are false. I know these stories are tantalizing or amusing, but they are not true. Why they should be located in China, I am not sure, especially since the country with the least regulation of genetic experiments is the United States. You can do almost anything there. It was there that a gibbon was successfully mated with a siamang, primates that are genetically more distant than a human and chimp. Several live births resulted. This happened at Georgia State University almost 30 years ago.
He then opened the floor to questions. According to the transcript,
"Question. Dr. Shen, is the U.S. working on a chimp hybrid?"
"Dr. Shen, I have no reason to think so. I am merely observing that the U.S. has the fewest rules."
"Question. Is it possible to fertilize a chimpanzee with human sperm?"
"Dr. Shen, I would say no. That has been tried for nearly a century, going back to the 1920s, when Stalin ordered the most famous animal breeder in Russia to do it, to make a new race of soldiers for him. His name was Ivanov, and he failed and was thrown in jail. A few years later, Hitler's scientists tried it and also failed. Today we know that the genomes of humans and chimps are very close, but the uterine conditions are considerably different. So I would say no."
"Question. Could it be done with genetic engineering?"
"Dr. Shen, that is difficult to say. It would be extremely difficult from a technical standpoint. From an ethical standpoint, I would say it is impossible."
"Question. But an American scientist already applied to patent a human hybrid."
"Dr. Shen, Professor Stuart Newman of New York was refused a patent on a part-human hybrid, but he did not make a hybrid. Dr. Newman said he applied for the patent to draw attention to the ethical issues involved. The ethical issues remain unresolved."
"Question.
Dr. Shen, do you think a hybrid will eventually be created?
Dr. Shen, I called this press conference to end speculation, not to increase it. But if you ask my personal opinion, I think, yes, it will eventually be done.
The memory haunted Mark Sanger. The image burned in his mind of that poor animal, stranded on the beach at night in Costa Rica, helpless as the jaguar pounced, bit off her head, and proceeded to eat the flesh while her legs still kicked feebly, and all with the sound of crunching bones, the bones of her head. Mark Sanger had not expected to see anything so horrific. He had come to the beach at Tortuguero to witness the giant leatherback turtles crawling out of the ocean to lay their eggs in the sand. As a biologist, he knew this was a great migration the planet had witnessed for countless eons. The female turtles were engaged in one of the great demonstrations of maternal caring, crawling high onto the beach, depositing their eggs deep in the ground, covering them with exhausted flippers, then carefully sweeping the sand clean, obliterating any trace of the eggs beneath. It was a slow, gentle ceremony, directed by genes that survive from millennia past. Then came the jaguar, a black streak in the night, and suddenly last summer everything changed for Mark Sanger. The brutality of the attack, its speed and viciousness, shocked him profoundly. It confirmed his suspicion that the natural world had gone badly wrong. Everything that mankind was doing on the planet had upset the delicate balance of nature. The pollution, the rampant industrialization, the loss of habitat. When animals were squeezed and cornered, they behaved viciously in a desperate effort to survive. That was the explanation for the ghastly attack he had witnessed. The natural world was in collapse. He mentioned this to the very handsome naturalist Ramon Valdez, who had accompanied him. Valdez shook his head. No, Señor Sanger, this is always the way it has been, since my father and grandfather before. They always spoke of the jaguar attacks in the night. It is part of the cycle of life. But there are more attacks now, Sanger said, because of all the pollution. No, Señor, there is no change. Every month, the jaguars take 2 to 4 turtles. We have records going back many years. The violence we see here is not normal. A short distance away, the jaguar was still eating the mother, bones still crunching. But it is normal, Ramon Valdez said. It is the way things are. Sanger did not want to talk about it anymore. Clearly, Valdez was an apologist for the industrialists and polluters, the big American companies that dominated Costa Rica and other Latin American countries. Not surprising to find such a person here, since the CIA had controlled Costa Rica for decades. This wasn't a country. It was a subsidiary of American business interests, and American businesses did not give a damn for the environment. Ramon Valdez said, "The jaguars must eat, too. I think better a turtle than to take a human baby." That, Mark Sanger thought, was a matter of opinion. Back at home in Berkeley, Sanger sat in his loft and pondered what to do. Although Sanger told people he was a biologist, he had no formal training in the field. He had attended 1 year of college before dropping out to work briefly for a landscape architecture firm, Cather and Holly. The only biology he had taken was a course in high school. The son of a banker, Sanger possessed a substantial trust fund and did not need to work to support himself. He did, however, need a purpose in life. Wealth, in his experience, made the quest for self-identity even more difficult, and the older he got, the harder it was to think about going back and finishing college. Recently, he had started to define himself as an artist. An artist did not need formal training. In fact, formal education interfered with the artist's ability to feel the zeitgeist,
to ride the waves of change rolling through society and to formulate a response to them. Sanger was very well informed in his opinion. He read the Berkeley papers and sometimes magazines like Mother Jones and several of the environmental magazines. Not every month, but sometimes. True, he often just looked at the pictures, skimming the stories, but that was all that was necessary to track the zeitgeist. Art was about feeling, about how it felt to live in this materialistic world with its gaudy luxuries, false promises, and profound disappointments. What was wrong with people today was that they ignored their feelings. It was the job of art to bring true feelings alive, to shock people into awareness. That was why so many young artists were using genetic techniques and living material to create art. Wet art, they called it. Tissue art. Many artists now worked full-time in science labs, and the art that resulted was distinctly scientific. One artist had grown steaks in a petri dish and then ate them in public as a performance. Supposedly, they tasted awful. Anyway, they were genetically modified. Ugh! An artist in France had made a glowing bunny rabbit by inserting luminescent genes from a firefly or something. And still other artists had changed the hair color of animals, giving them rainbow hues, and had grown porcupine quills on the head of a cute puppy. These works of art provoked strong feelings. Many people were disgusted, but then Sanger thought they should be disgusted. They should feel the same revulsion that he himself had felt watching the slaughter of a mother turtle by a jaguar on a beach in Costa Rica. That horrid perversion of nature, that repellent savagery that he could not put out of his mind. And that, of course, was the reason to make art. Not art for art's sake, rather art to benefit the world, art to help the environment. That was Mark Sanger's goal, and he set about to attain it. Local doctor arrested for organ theft. Long Beach Hospital staff are implicated. Thieves sold bones, blood, organs. A prominent Long Beach physician has been arrested for selling organs illegally removed from dead bodies at Long Beach Memorial Hospital. Dr. Martin Roberts, chief administrator of the pathology laboratory, which conducts autopsies at the hospital, was charged on 143 counts of illegally harvesting body parts from cadavers and selling the contraband to tissue banks. Said Long Beach District Attorney Barbara Bates, "This indictment reads like a B-movie horror story." Bates also alleged in her indictment that Dr. Roberts forged death certificates, falsified lab results, and colluded with local funeral homes and cemeteries to conceal his reign of error. The case is only the most recent episode in a nationwide pandemic of modern-day body snatching. Other cases include Dr. Mike Mastromarino, a millionaire Brooklyn, New York dentist who over a 5-year period purportedly stole organs from thousands of cadavers, including bones from the 95-year-old Alastair Cook. A Fort Lee, New Jersey biomedical firm that sold Mastromarino's body parts to tissue banks across the United States. A crematorium in San Diego alleged to have stolen body parts from the cadavers entrusted to it. Another in Lake Elsinore, California, where body parts were kept in huge freezers prior to sale, and UCLA Medical Center, where 500 bodies were cut up and sold for $700,000, some to the firm of Johnson & Johnson. "The problem is worldwide," said D.A. Bates. "Tissue theft has been reported in England, Canada, Australia, Russia, Germany, and France. We believe such thefts now occur everywhere in the world," Bates added. "Patients are very concerned." Dr. Roberts pleaded innocent to all charges in Superior Court and was released on a $1 million bond. Also indicted were four other Long Beach Memorial Hospital staffers, including Marilee Hunter, the head of the hospital genetics lab. Long Beach Memorial Administrator Kevin McCormick expressed shock at the indictments and said that
Dr. Roberts' behavior contravenes everything that our institution stands for. He said he had ordered a thorough review of hospital procedures and would make the report public when it was completed. Prosecutors say the events were brought to their attention by a whistleblower, Raza Rashad. Mr. Rashad is a first-year medical student in San Francisco who had previously worked in Dr. Roberts' pathology lab, where he had witnessed firsthand numerous illegal activities there. Mr. Rashad's testimony was vital to building the prosecutor's case, Bates said. Josh Winkler hurried into the animal facility to see what Tom Weller was talking about. "How many rats died?" he said.
"Nine."
The stiff bodies of nine dead rats lying on their sides in nine successive cages made Josh Winkler start to sweat.
"We'll have to dissect them," he said. "When did they die?"
"Must have been during the night," Tom said. "They were fed at 6, no notation of problems then."
Tom was looking at a clipboard.
"What study group were they in?"
Josh said, fearing he already knew the answer.
A7, Tom said. "The maturity gene study."
Jesus. Josh tried to remain calm. "And how old were they?"
Let's see. 38 weeks and 4 days.
Oh, God. The average lifespan of a lab rat was 160 weeks, a little over 3 years.
These rats had died in a quarter of that time. He took a deep breath.
"And what about the others in the cohort?"
"There were 20 in the original study group," Tom said. "All identical, all the same age. Two of them died a few days ago of respiratory infection. I didn't think much about it at the time. As for the others, well, you better see for yourself."
He led Josh down the row of cages to the other rats. It was immediately clear what their condition was. Ragged coats, inactive, excessive sleeping, trouble standing on their hind legs, muscle wasting, hind leg paralysis in 4 of them.
Josh stared. "They're old," he said. "They're all old."
"Yes," Tom said. "It's unmistakable. Premature aging. I went back and checked the dead rats from 2 days ago. One had a pituitary adenoma, and the other had spinal cord degeneration."
"Signs of age."
"Right," Tom said. "Signs of age. Maybe this gene won't be the wonder product Rick is counting on after all. Not if it causes early death. It'd be a disaster."
"How am I feeling?" Adam said as they sat together at lunch. "I feel fine, Josh, thanks to you. I'm a little tired sometimes, and my skin is dry. I'm getting a few wrinkles, but I feel okay. Why?"
"Just wondered,"
Josh said as casually as he could. He tried not to stare at his older brother. In fact, Adam's appearance had changed dramatically. Where he once had a touch of gray at the temples, he now had a full head of salt-and-pepper hair. His hairline had receded. The skin around his eyes and lips was noticeably wrinkled. His forehead was deeply creased. He looked much older. Adam was 32.
"Jesus. No, drugs?"
Josh asked.
"No, no. That's over, thank God," Adam said.
He had ordered a hamburger, but he put it down after a few bites.
"Doesn't taste good?"
"Got a sore tooth. I need to see the dentist."
Adam touched his cheek. "I hate complaining. Actually, I was thinking I'd better get some exercise. I need exercise. Sometimes I get constipated."
"You going to join your old b-ball group?"
Josh said brightly. His brother used to play basketball twice a week with the investment bankers.
"Ah, no," Adam said. "I was thinking doubles, tennis, or maybe golf."
"Good idea," Josh said. A silence fell over the table. Adam pushed his plate aside.
"I know I look older," he said. "You don't need to pretend you haven't noticed. Everybody's noticed it. I asked Mom, and she said that Dad was the same way. He just suddenly looked older in his 30s, almost overnight.
So, maybe it's genetic.
Yeah, could be.
Why? Adam said. Do you know something?
Me? No.
You just suddenly wanted to have lunch urgently today, couldn't wait?
I hadn't seen you in a while, that's all.
Cut the crap, Josh, he said. You were always a shitty liar. Josh sighed.
Adam, he said, I think we should do some tests.
For what?
Bone density, lung capacity, and an MRI.
For what?
What are these tests for?
He stared at Josh. For aging?
Yes.
I'm aging too fast? Is it that gene spray?
We need to find out, Josh said. I want to call Ernie.
Ernie Lawrence was the family physician.
Okay, set it up.